her eyes heavy from sleep.
"Drink," she said, lifting Danny's head to the cup once more, but this time it was only wine. Sweet, sweet wine.
Danny drank and lay back, listening to the soft sounds of her own breathing. She could feel the heaviness in her limbs as sleep crept in and filled her up once more. "Bring me," she murmured, her voice slurred and drowsy. "Bring. I want to hold."
"Yes,"
the Magi asked.
"What is it you wish, Khaleesi?"
"Bring me egg. Dragon's egg, please." Her lashes turned to lead, and she was too weary to hold them up. When she woke the third time, a shaft of golden sunlight was pouring through the smoke hole of the tent, and her arms were wrapped around a dragon's egg. It was the pale one, its scales the colour of buttercream. Vain were the walls of gold and bronze, and Danny could feel the heat of it. Beneath her bed silks, a fine sheen of perspiration covered her bare skin. Dragon dew, she thought. Her fingers trailed lightly across the surface of the shell, tracing the wisps of gold, and deep in the stone she felt something twist and stretch in response. It did not frighten her. All her fear was gone, burned away. Danny touched her brow. Under the film of sweat, her skin was cool to the touch, her fever gone. She made herself sit. There was a moment of dizziness and the deep ache between her thighs, yet she felt strong. Her maids came running at the sound of her voice. "Water," she told them. "A flagon of water, cold as you can find it, and fruit, I think. Dates."
"As you say, Khaleesi."
"I want Sir Jorah," she said, standing. Jiqui brought a sand silk robe and draped it over her shoulders, "and a warm bath, and Miramar's door, and—" Memory came back to her, all at once, and she faltered. "Khal Drogo," she forced herself to say, watching their faces with dread. "Is he—" "The Khal lives," Ira answered quietly, yet Danny saw a darkness in her eyes when she said the words, and no sooner had she spoken than she rushed away to fetch water. She turned to Doria. "Tell me."
I shall bring Sir Jorah," the Lysine girl said, bowing her head and fleeing the tent.
Jiqui would have run as well, but Danny caught her by the wrist and held her captive.
"What is it? I must know. Drogo and my child." Why had she not remembered the child until now? "My son, Rago, where is he? I want him."
Her handmaiden lowered her eyes.
"The boy, he did not live, Khaleesi."
Her face was a frightened whisper. Danny released her wrist. "My son is dead," she thought, as Jiqui left the tent. She had known somehow. She had known since she woke the first time to Jiqui's tears. No, she had known before she woke. Her dream came back to her, sudden and vivid, and she remembered the tall man with the copper skin and the long silver-gold braid bursting into flame. She should weep, she knew, yet her eyes were dry as ash. She had wept in her dream, and the tears had turned to steam on her cheeks. "All the grief has been burned out of me," she told herself. She felt sad, and yet she could feel Rago receding from her, as if he had never been. Sir Jorah and Miramar's door entered a few moments later and found Danny standing over the other dragon's eggs, the two still in their chest. It seemed to her that they felt as hot as the one she had slept with, which was passing strange. "Sir Jorah, come here," she said. She took his hand and placed it on the black egg with the scarlet swirls. "What do you feel?"
"Shell, hard as rock." The knight was wary. "Scales."
"Heat?"
"No, cold stone.
He took his hand away. "Princess, are you well? Should you be up, weak as you are?" "Weak? I am strong, Jorah." To please him, she reclined on a pile of cushions. "Tell me how my child died."
"He never lived, my princess. The women say..."
He faltered, and Danny saw how the flesh hung loose on him and the way he limped when he moved. "Tell me. Tell me what the women say." He turned his face away. His eyes were haunted.
"They say the child was..."
She waited, but Sir Jorah could not say it. His face grew dark with shame. He looked half a corpse himself.
"Monstrous,"
Miramazdur finished for him. The knight was a powerful man, yet Danny understood in that moment that the Magi was stronger and crueler and infinitely more dangerous.
"Twisted. I drew him forth myself. He was scaled like a lizard, blind, with the stub of a tail and small leather wings like the wings of a bat. When I touched him, the flesh sloughed off the bone, and inside he was full of grave worms and the stink of corruption. He had been dead for years."
Darkness, Danny thought, the terrible darkness sweeping up behind to devour her. If she looked back, she was lost. "My son was alive and strong when Sir Jorah carried me into this tent," she said. "I could feel him kicking, fighting to be born."
"That may be as it may be," answered Miramazdur. "Yet the creature that came forth from your womb was as I said. Death was in that tent, Khaleesi."
"Only shadows," Sir Jorah asked, but Danny could hear the doubt in his voice. "I saw, Meji, I saw you alone, dancing with the shadows."
"The grave casts long shadows, Iron Lord," Miri said. "Long and dark, and in the end, no light can hold them back."
Sir Jorah had killed her son, Danny knew. He'd done what he did for love and loyalty. Yet he had carried her into a place no living man should go, and fed her baby to the darkness. He knew it too. The grey face, the hollow eyes, the limp. "The shadows have touched you too, Sir Jorah," she told him. The knight made no reply. Danny turned to the god's wife. "You warned me that only death could pay for life. I thought you meant the horse."
"No,"
Miramazdur said.
"That was a lie you told yourself. You knew the price."
"Had she? Had she? If I look back, I'm lost." "The price was paid," Danny said. "The horse, my child, Quaro, Kotho, Hago, Kaholo. The price was paid and paid and paid." She rose from her cushions. "Where is Khal Drogo? Show him to me. God's wife, Meiji, blood mange, whatever you are, show me Khal Drogo. Show me what I bought with my son's life."
"As you command, Khaleesi," the old woman said. "Come, I will take you to him."
Danny was weaker than she knew. Sir Jorah slipped an arm around her and helped her stand.
"A time and office later, my princess," he said quietly.
"I would see him now, Sir Jorah." After the dimness of the tent, the world outside was blinding bright. The sun burned like molten gold, and the land was seared and empty. Her handmaids waited with fruit and wine and water, and Jogo moved close to help Sir Jorah support her. Ego and Rakaro stood behind. The glare of sun on sand made it hard to see more, until Danny raised her hand to shade her eyes. She saw the ashes of a fire, a few score horses milling listlessly and searching for a bite of grass, a scattering of tents and bedrolls. A small crowd of children had gathered to watch her, and beyond she glimpsed women going about their work, and withered old men staring at the flat blue sky with tired eyes, swatting feebly at blood flies. A count might show 100 people, no more. Where the other 40,000 had made their camp, only the wind and dust live now. "Drogo's Khalasar is gone," she said. "A Karl who cannot ride is no Karl," said Jogo. "The Dothraki follow only the strong," Ser Jorah said. "I'm sorry, my princess, there was no way to hold them. Ko Pono left first, naming himself Karl Pono, and many followed him. Jago was not long to do the same. The rest slipped away night by night in large bands and small. There are a dozen new Khalasars on the Dothraki Sea, where once there was only Drogo's."
"The old remain," said Aego, "the frightened, the weak, and the sick. And we who swore we remain."
"They took Khal Drogo's herds, Khaleesi," Rakaro said. "We were too few to stop them. It is the right of the strong to take from the weak. They took many slaves as well, the Khals and yours. Yet they left some few." "Iroa?" asked Danny, remembering the frightened child she had saved outside the city of the Lamb Men.
"Mago seized her, who is Karl Jago's blood rider now," said Jogo. "He mounted her high and low and gave her to his Karl, and Jago gave her to his other blood riders. They were six. When they were done with her, they cut her throat. It was her fate, Khaleesi," said Aego.
"If I look back, I'm lost."
"It was a cruel fate," Danny said, "yet not so cruel as Mago's will be, I promise you that, by the old gods and the new, by the lamb god and the horse god and every god that lives. I swear it by the mother of mountains and the womb of the world. Before I am done with them, Mago and Kojako will plead for the mercy they showed Iroa."
The Dothraki exchanged uncertain glances. Khaleesi, the handmaid Iri, explained, as if to a child,
"Jako is a Karl now, with 20,000 riders at his back."
She lifted her head. "And I am Daenerys Stormborn, Daenerys of House Targaryen, of the blood of Aegon the Conqueror, and Maegor the Cruel, and old Valyria before them. I am the dragon's daughter, and I swear to you, these men will die screaming. Now bring me to Khal Drogo." He was lying on the bare, red earth, staring up at the sun. A dozen blood flies had settled on his body, though he did not seem to feel them. Danny brushed them away and knelt beside him. His eyes were wide open, but he did not see, and she knew at once that he was blind. When she whispered his name, he did not seem to hear. The wound on his breast was as healed as it ever would be, the scar that covered it grey and red and hideous. "Why is he out here alone in the sun?" she asked him.
"Well, he seemed to like the warmth, princess," Ser Jorah said. "His eyes follow the sun, though he does not see it. He can walk, after a fashion. He will go where you lead him, but no further. He will eat if you put food in his mouth, drink if you dribble water on his lips."
Danny kissed her sun and stars gently on the brow, and stood to face Mirror Mazdur. "Your spells are costly, Meji."
"He lives," said Mirror Mazdur. "You asked for life. You paid for life."
"This is not life. For one who was as Drogo was, his life was laughter and meat roasting over a fire pit and a horse between his legs. His life was an arrack in his hand and his bells ringing in his hair as he rode to meet an enemy. His life was his blood riders and me and the son I was to give him." Mirror Mazdur made no reply. "When will he be as he was?" Danny demanded.
"When the sun rises in the west and sets in the east," said Mirror Mazdur. "When the seas go dry and mountains blow in the wind like leaves. When your womb quickens again and you bear a living child. Then he will return, and not before."
Danny gestured at Ser Jorah and the others. Leave us. I would speak with this Magi alone. Mormont and the Dothraki withdrew.
You knew, Dany said when they were gone. She ached inside and out, but her fury gave her strength. You knew what I was buying, and you knew the price, and yet you let me pay it.
It was wrong of them to burn my temple, the heavy, flat-nosed woman said pleasantly. That angered the great shepherd.
This was no God's work, Danny said coldly.
If I look back, I am lost.
You cheated me. You murdered my child within me.
The stallion who mounts the world will burn no cities now. His Khalasar shall trample no nations into dust.
I spoke for you, she said anguished. I saved you.
Save me?
The Lazarine woman spat.
Three riders had taken me, not as a man takes a woman, but from behind as a dog takes a bitch. The fourth was in me when you rode past. How then did you save me? I saw my God's house burn. What I had healed, good men beyond counting. My home they burned as well. And in the street I saw piles of heads. I saw the head of a baker who made my bread. I saw the head of a boy I had saved from dead-eye fever only 3 moons past. I heard children crying as the riders drove them off with their whips. Tell me again what you saved.
Your life. Miri Maz Dua laughed cruelly.
Look to your Carl and see what life is worth when all the rest is gone.
Danny called out for the men of her cars and bid them take Miramar's door and bind her hand and foot. But the Magi smiled at her as they carried her off, as if they shared a secret. A word, and Danny could have her head off. Yet then what would she have? A head? If life was worthless, what was death? They led Khal Drogo back to her tent. And Danny commanded them to fill a tub, and this time there was no blood in the water. She bathed him herself, washing the dirt and the dust from his arms and chest, cleaning his face with a soft cloth, soaping his long black hair, and combing the knots and tangles from it until it shone again, as she remembered. It was well past dark before she was done, and Danny was exhausted. She stopped for drink and food, but it was all she could do to nibble at a fig and keep down a mouthful of water. Sleep would have been a release, but she had slept enough, too long, in truth. She owed this night to Drogo, for all the nights that had been, and yet might be. The memory of their first ride was with her, when she led him out into the darkness. For the Dothraki believed that all things of importance in a man's life must be done beneath the open sky. She told herself that there were powers stronger than hatred, and spells older and truer than any the Magi had learned in Ashai. The night was black and moonless, but overhead a million stars burned bright. She took that for an omen. No soft blanket of grass welcomed them here, only the hard, dusty ground, bare and strewn with stones. No trees stirred in the wind, and there was no stream to soothe her fears with the gentle music of water. Danny told herself that the stars would be enough. "Remember, Drogo," she whispered. "Remember our first ride together, the day we wed? Remember the night we made Rago, with the Khalasar all around us and your eyes on my face? Remember how cool and clean the water was in the womb of the world? Remember my sun and stars? Remember and come back to me." The birth had left her too raw and torn to take him inside of her, as she would have wanted. But Doria had taught her other ways. Danny used her hands, her mouth, her breasts. She raked him with her nails and covered him with kisses
and whispered and prayed and told him stories. And by the end, she had bathed him with her tears. Yet Drogo did not feel or speak or rise. And when the bleak dawn broke over an empty horizon, Danny knew he was truly lost to her. When the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, she said sadly, when the seas go dry and mountains blow in the wind like leaves, when my womb quickens again and I bear a living child, then you will return, my sun and stars, and not before. Never, the darkness cried, never, never, never. Inside the tent, Danny found a cushion, soft silk stuffed with feathers. She clutched it to her breasts as she walked back out to Drogo, to her sun and stars. If I look back, I am lost. It hurt even to walk, and she wanted to sleep. To sleep and not to dream. She knelt, kissed Drogo on the lips, and pressed the cushion down across his face. John. When Corin Halfhand told him to find some brush for a fire, John knew their end was near. It will be good to feel warm again, if only for a little while, he told himself while he hacked bare branches from the trunk of a dead tree. Ghost sat on his haunches watching, silent as ever. Will he howl for me when I'm dead? As Bran's wolf howled when he fell, John wondered. Will Shaggy Dog howl far off in Winterfell, and Grey Wind and Nymeria, wherever they might be? The moon was rising behind one mountain and the sun sinking behind another, as John struck sparks from flint and dagger until finally a wisp of smoke appeared. Corin came and stood over him as the first flame rose up, flickering from the shavings of bark and dead dry pine needles. "As shy as a maiden on her wedding night," the big ranger said in a soft voice, "and near as fair. Sometimes a man forgets how pretty a fire can be." He was not a man you'd expect to speak of maids and wedding nights. So far as John knew, Corin had spent his whole life in the Watch. Did he ever love a maid or have a wedding? He could not ask. Instead, he fanned the fire. When the blaze was all a crackle, he peeled off his stiff gloves to warm his hands and sighed, wondering if ever a kiss had felt as good. The warmth spread through his fingers like melting butter. The half-hand eased himself to the ground and sat cross-legged by the fire, the flickering light playing across the hard planes of his face. Only the two of them remained of the five rangers who had fled the Skirling Pass back into the blue-grey wilderness of the Frostfangs. At first John had nursed the hope that Squire Dalbridge would keep the wildlings bottled up in the pass, but when they'd heard the call of a far-off horn, every man of them knew that the squire had fallen. Later they spied the eagle soaring through the dusk on great blue-grey wings, and Stone Snake unslung his bow, but the bird flew out of range before he could so much as string it. Ebon spat and muttered darkly of wargs and skin changers. They glimpsed the eagle twice more the day after, and heard the hunting horn behind them echoing against the mountains. Each time it seemed a little louder, a little closer. When night fell, the half-hand told Ebon to take the squire's garron, as well as his own, and ride east for Mormont with all haste, back the way they had come. The rest of them would draw off the pursuit. "Send John," Ebon had urged. "He can ride as fast as me. John has a different part to play. He is half a boy still." "No," said Corin, "he is a man of the night's watch." When the moon rose, Ebon parted from them. Stone Snake went east with him a short way, then doubled back to obscure their tracks, and the three who remained set off toward the southwest.
After that, the days and nights blurred one into the other. They slept in their saddles and stopped only long enough to feed and water the Garens, then mounted up again. Over bare rock they rode, through gloomy pine forests and drifts of old snow, over icy ridges and across shallow rivers that had no names. Sometimes Corran or Stone Snake would loop back to sweep away their tracks, but it was a futile gesture. They were watched. At every dawn and every dusk, they saw the eagle soaring between the peaks, no more than a speck in the vastness of the sky. They were scaling a low ridge between two snow-capped peaks when a shadow cat came snarling from its lair, not 10 yards away. The beast was gaunt and half-starved, but the sight of it sent Stone Snake's mare into a panic. She reared and ran, and before the ranger could get her back under control, she had stumbled on the steep slope and broken her leg. Ghost ate well that day, and Corran insisted that the rangers mix some of the Garen's blood with their oats to give them strength. The taste of that foul porridge almost choked John, but he forced it down. They each cut a dozen strips of raw, stringy meat from the carcass to chew on as they rode, and left the rest for the Shadow Cats. There was no question of riding double. Stone Snake offered to lay in wait for the pursuit and surprise them when they came. Perhaps he could take a few of them with him down to hell? Corran refused.
If any man in the Night's Watch can make it through the Frost Fangs alone and afoot, it is you, brother. You can go over mountains that a horse must go around. Make for the Fist. Tell Mormont what John saw and how. Tell him that the old powers are waking, that he faces giants and wargs and worse. Tell him that the trees have eyes again.
He has no chance, John thought, when he watched Stone Snake vanish over a snow-covered ridge, a tiny black bug crawling across a rippling expanse of white. After that, every night seemed colder than the night before, and more lonely. Ghost was not always with them, but he was never far either. Even when they were apart, John sensed his nearness. He was glad for that. The half-hand was not the most companionable of men. Corran's long grey braid swung slowly with the motion of his horse. Often they would ride for hours without a word spoken. The only sounds, the soft scrape of horseshoes on stone and the keening of the wind which blew endlessly through the heights. When he slept, he did not dream, not of wolves, nor his brothers, nor anything. Even dreams cannot live up here, he told himself. Is your sword sharp, Jon Snow? Asked Corran Halfhand across the flickering fire. My sword is Valyrian steel. The old bear gave it to me.
Do you remember the words of your vow?
Yes. They were not words a man was like to forget. Once said, they could never be unsaid. They changed your life forever.
Say them again, with me, Jon Snow.
If you like. Their voices blended as one beneath the rising moon, while ghosts listened and the mountains themselves bore witness.
Night gathers, and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword in the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men. I pledge my life and honour to the Night's Watch for this night and all the nights to come.
When they were done, there was no sound but the faint crackle of the flames and a distant sigh of wind. John opened and closed his burnt fingers, holding tight to the words in his mind, praying that his father's gods would give him the strength to die bravely when his hour came. It would not be long now. The Garens were near the end of their strength. Corran's mount would not last another day, John suspected. The flames were burning low by then,
the warmth fading. "The fire will soon go out," Corin said. "But if the wall should ever fall, all the fires would go out."
There was nothing John could say to that. He nodded.
"We may escape them yet," the ranger said. "Or not."
"I'm not afraid to die." It was only half a lie.
"It may not be so easy as that, John."
He did not understand. "What do you mean?"
"If we are taken, you must yield."
"Yield?" He blinked in disbelief. "The wildlings did not make captives of the men they call the crows. They killed them, except for... they only spare oathbreakers, those who join them, like Mance Raider."
"And you?"
"No," he shook his head. "Never, I won't."
"You will. I command it of you."
"Command it, but..."
"Our honour means no more than our lives, so long as the realm is safe. Are you a man of the Night's Watch?"
"Yes, but there is no but, Jon Snow. You are, or you are not." Jon sat up straight. "I am."
"Then hear me. If we are taken, you will go over to them, as the wildling girl you captured once urged you. They may demand that you cut your cloak to ribbons, that you swear them an oath on your father's grave, that you curse your brothers and your Lord Commander. You must not balk. Whatever is asked of you, do as they bid you. But in your heart, remember who and what you are. Ride with them, eat with them, fight with them, for as long as it takes, and watch."
"For what?" John asked.
"Would that I knew," said Corin. "Your wolves saw their diggings in the Valley of the Milkwater. What did they seek in such a bleak and distant place? Did they find it? That is what you must learn before you return to Lord Mormont and your brothers. That is the duty I lay on you, Jon Snow."
"I'll do as you say," Jon said reluctantly. "But you will tell them, won't you? The old bear, at least. You'll tell him that I never broke my oath." Corin Halfhand gazed at him across the fire, his eyes lost in pools of shadow.
"When I see him next, I swear it."
He gestured at the fire.
"More wood. I want it bright and hot."
John went to cut more branches, snapping each one in two before tossing it into the flames. The tree had been dead a long time, but it seemed to live again in the fire, as fiery dancers woke within each stick of wood to whirl and spin in their glowing gowns of yellow, red, and orange.
"Enough," Corin said abruptly. "Now we ride."
"Ride?" It was dark beyond the fire. The night was cold. "Ride where?"
"Back."
Corin mounted his weary garron one more time.
"The fire will draw them past, I hope. Come, brother."
John pulled on his gloves again and raised his hood. Even the horses seemed reluctant to leave the fire. The sun was long gone, and only the cold silver shine of the half-moon remained to light their way over the treacherous ground that lay behind them. He did not know what Corin had in mind, but perhaps it was a chance. He hoped so. "I do not want to play the oathbreaker, even for good reason." They went cautiously, moving as silent as man and horse could move, retracing their steps until they reached the mouth of a narrow defile, where an icy little stream emerged from between two mountains. John remembered the place. They had watered the horses here before the sun went down.
"The water's icing up,"
Corin observed as he turned aside.
"Else we'd ride in the stream bed. But if we break the ice, they're like to see. Keep close to the cliffs. There's a crook a half mile on that will hide us."
He rode into the defile. John gave one last wistful look at their distant fire and followed. The farther in they went, the closer the cliffs pressed to either side. They followed the moonlit ribbon of stream back toward its source. Icicles bearded its stony banks, but John could still hear the sound of rushing water beneath the thin, hard crust. A great jumble of fallen rock
block their way part way up, where a section of the cliff face had fallen. But the sure-footed little Garrons were able to pick their way through. Beyond, the walls pinched in sharply, and the stream led them to the foot of a tall, twisting waterfall. The air was full of mist, like the breath of some vast cold beast. The tumbling waters shone silver in the moonlight. John looked about in dismay. There is no way out. He and Curran might be able to climb the cliffs, but not with the horses. He did not think they would last long afoot.
"Quickly now," the half-hand commanded.
The big man, on the small horse, rode over the ice-slick stones right into the curtain of water and vanished. When he did not reappear, John put his heels into his horse and went after. His Garen did his best to shy away. The falling water slapped at them with frozen fists, and the shock of the cold seemed to stop John's breath. Then he was through, drenched and shivering, but through. The cleft in the rock was barely large enough for man and horse to pass, but beyond, the walls opened up, and the floor turned to soft sand. John could feel the spray freezing in his beard. Ghost burst through the waterfall in an angry rush, shook droplets from his fur, sniffed at the darkness suspiciously, then lifted a leg against one rocky wall. Curran had already dismounted. John did the same. "You knew this place was here?"
"When I was no older than you, I heard a brother tell how he followed a shadow cat through these falls."
He unsaddled his horse, removed her bitten bridle, and ran his fingers through her shaggy mane.
"There is a way through the heart of the mountain. Come dawn, if they have not found us, we will press on. The first watch is mine, brother."
Curran seated himself on the sand, his back to a wall, no more than a vague black shadow in the gloom of the cave. Over the rush of falling water, John heard the soft sound of steel on leather that could only mean that the half-hand had drawn his sword. He took off his wet cloak, but it was too cold and damp here to strip down any further. Ghost stretched out beside him and licked his glove before curling up to sleep. John was grateful for his warmth. He wondered if the fire was still burning outside, or if it had gone out by now. If the wall should ever fall, all the fires would go out. The moon shone through the curtain of falling water to lay a shimmering pale stripe across the sand, but after a while that too faded and went dark. Sleep came at last, and with it nightmares. He dreamed of burning castles and dead men rising unquiet from their graves. It was still dark when Curran woke him. While the half-hand slept, John sat with his back to the cave wall, listening to the water and waiting for the dawn. At break of day, they each chewed a half-frozen strip of horse meat, then saddled their Garrons once again and fastened their black cloaks around their shoulders. During his watch, the half-hand had made a half-dozen torches, soaking bundles of dry moss with the oil he carried in his saddlebag. He lit the first one now, and led the way down into the dark, holding the pale flame up before him. John followed with the horses. The stony path twisted and turned, first down, then up, then down more steeply. In spots it grew so narrow, it was hard to convince the Garrons they could squeeze through. "By the time we come out, we will have lost them," he told himself as they went. "Not even an eagle can see through solid stone. We will have lost them, and we will ride hard for the fist and tell the old bear all we know." But when they emerged back into the light, long hours later, the eagle was waiting for them, perched on a dead tree 100 feet up the slope. Ghost went bounding up the rocks after it, but the bird flapped its wings and took to the air. Curran's mouth tightened as he followed its flight with his eyes.
"Here is as good a place as any to make a stand," he declared. "The mouth of the cave shelters us from above, and they cannot get behind us without passing through the mountain. "Is your sword sharp, Jon Snow?" "Yes," he said. "We'll feed the horses. They've served us bravely, poor beasts."
John gave his Garen the last of the oats and stroked his shaggy mane while Ghost prowled restlessly amongst the rocks. He pulled his gloves on tighter and flexed his burnt fingers. "I am the shield that guards the realms of men." A hunting horn echoed through the mountains, and a moment later John heard the baying of hounds.
"They will be with us soon," announced Corrin. "Keep your wolf in hand."
"Ghost, to me," John called. The dire wolf returned reluctantly to his side, tail held stiffly behind him. The wildlings came boiling over a ridge not half a mile away. Their hounds ran before them, snarling, grey-brown beasts with more than a little wolf in their blood. Ghost bared his teeth, his fur bristling. "Easy," John murmured. "Stay." Overhead, he heard the rustle of wings. The eagle landed on an outcrop of rock and screamed in triumph. The hunters approached warily, perhaps fearing arrows. John counted 14, with 8 dogs. Their large, round shields were made of skins stretched over woven wicker and painted with skulls. About half of them hid their faces behind crude helms of wood and boiled leather. On either wing, archers notched shafts to the strings of small wooden horn bows, but did not loose. The rest seemed to be armed with spears and mauls. One had a chipped stone axe. They wore only what bits of armor they had looted from dead rangers or stolen during raids. Wildlings did not mine or smelt, and there were few smiths and fewer forges north of the wall. Corrin drew his longsword. The tale of how he had taught himself to fight with his left hand, after losing half of his right, was part of his legend. It was said that he handled blade better now than he ever had before. John stood shoulder to shoulder with the big ranger and pulled Longclaw from its sheath. Despite the chill in the air, sweat stung his eyes. 10 yards below the cave mouth, the hunters halted. Their leader came on alone, riding a beast that seemed more goat than horse from the sure-footed way it climbed the uneven slope. As man and mount grew nearer, John could hear them clattering. Both were armored in bones, cow bones, sheep bones, the bones of goats and oryx and elk, the great bones of the hairy mammoths, and human bones as well.
"Rattleshirt," Corrin called down, icy polite. "To crows I be the lord of bones."
The rider's helm was made from the broken skull of a giant, and all up and down his arms bear claws had been sewn to his boiled leather. Corrin snorted.
"I see no lord, only a dog dressed in chicken bones who rattles when he rides."
The wildling hissed in anger, and his mount reared.
"He did rattle. John could hear it. The bones were strung together loosely, so they clacked and clattered when he moved. It's your bones I'll be rattling soon, half-hand. I'll boil the flesh off you and make a burnie from your ribs. I'll carve your teeth to cast me runes and eat me oaten porridge from your skull. If you want my bones, come get them."
That, Rattleshirt seemed reluctant to do. His numbers meant little in the close confines of the rocks where the Black Brothers had taken their stand. To winkle them out of the cave, the wildlings would need to come up two at a time. But another of his company edged a horse up beside him, one of the fighting women called spearwives.
"We are 4 and 10 to 2, crows, and 8 dogs to your wolf," she called. "Fight or run, you are ours." "Show them," commanded Rattleshirt.
The woman reached into a blood-stained sack and drew out a trophy. Ebon had been as bald as an egg, so she dangled the head by an ear.
"He died brave," she said. "But he died," said Rattleshirt. "Same like you."
He freed his battle axe, brandishing it above his head. Good steel it was, with a wicked gleam to both blades. Eben was never a man to neglect his weapons. The other wildlings crowded forward beside him, yelling taunts. A few chose John for their mockery.
"Is that your wolf, boy?"
a skinny youth called, unlimbering a stone flail.
"It'll be my cloak before the sun is down."
On the other side of the line, another spearwife opened her ragged furs to show John a heavy white breast.
"Does the baby want his mama? Come have a shot at this boy."
The dogs were barking too.
"They would shame us into folly."
Corin gave John a long look.
"Remember your orders."
"Belike, we need to flush the crows,"
Rattleshirt bellowed over the clamour.
"Feather them."
"No!" The word burst from John's lips before the bowman could loose. He took two quick steps forward.
"We yield."
"They warned me bastard blood was craven,"
he heard Corin Halfhand say coldly behind him.
"I see it is so. Run to your new masters, coward."
Face reddening, John descended the slope to where Rattleshirt sat his horse. The wildling stared at him through the eye-holes of his helm and said,
"The free folk have no need of cravens."
One of the archers pulled off her sewn sheepskin helm and shook out a head of shaggy red hair. "This is the bastard of Winterfell, who spared me. Let him live." John met Ygritte's eyes and had no words.
"Let him die,"
insisted the Lord of Bones.
"The Black Crow is a tricksy bird. I trust him not."
On a rock above them, the eagle flapped its wings and split the air with a scream of fury.
"The bird hates you, Jon Snow," said Ygritte.
"And well he might. He was a man before you killed him." "I did not know," said John truthfully, trying to remember the face of the man he had slain in the pass. "You told me Mance would take me."
"And he will," Ygritte said. "Mance is not here," said Rattleshirt. "Ragwile got him."
The big spearwife narrowed her eyes and said,
"If the crow would join the free folk, let him show us his prowess and prove the truth of him."
"I'll do whatever you ask." The words came hard, but John said them. Rattleshirt's bone armor clattered loudly as he laughed.
"Then kill the Halfhand, bastard."
"As if he could," said Corin.
"Turn, Snow, and die."
And then Corin's sword was coming at him, and somehow Longclaw leapt upward to block. The force of impact almost knocked the bastard blade from John's hand and set him staggering backward. "You must not balk, whatever is asked of you." He shifted to a two-handed grip, quick enough to deliver a stroke of his own, but the big ranger brushed it aside with contemptuous ease. Back and forth they went, black cloak swirling, the youth's quickness against the savage strength of Corin's left-hand cuts. The Halfhand's longsaw seemed to be everywhere at once, raining down from one side and then the other, driving him where he would, keeping him off balance. Already he could feel his arms growing numb. Even when Ghost's teeth closed savagely around the ranger's calf, somehow Corin kept his feet. But in that instant, as he twisted, the opening was there. John planted and pivoted. The ranger was leaning away, and for an instant it seemed that John's slash had not touched him. Then a string of red tears appeared across the big man's throat, bright as a ruby necklace, and the blood gushed out of him, and Corin Halfhand fell. Ghost's muzzle was dripping red, but only the point of the bastard blade was stained, the last half inch. John pulled the direwolf away and knelt with one arm around him. The light was already fading in Corin's eyes.
"Sharp,"
he said, lifting his main fingers. Then the hand fell, and he was gone. "He knew," John thought numbly. "He knew what they would ask of me." He thought of Samwell Tarly then, of Gren, and Dolorous Ed, of Pip and Toad back at Castle Black. Had he lost them all, as he had lost Bran and Rickon and Rob? Who was he now? What was he?
"Get him up!"
Rough hands dragged him to his feet. John did not resist.
"Do you have a name?"
Ygritte answered for him. "His name is John Snow. He's Eddard Stark's blood of Winterfell." Ragwar laughed. "Who would have thought it? Corran Halfpan slain by some lordling's byblow."
"Got him!"
That was Rattleshirt, still a horse. The eagle flew to him and perched atop his bony helm, screeching. "He yielded," Ygritte reminded him. "Aye, and slew his brother," said a short, homely man in a rust-eaten iron half-helm. Rattleshirt rode closer, bones clattering.
"The wolf did his work for him. It were foully done. The half-hand's death was mine."
"We all saw how eager you were to take it," mocked Ragwile.
"Here's a warg," said the Lord of Bones, "and a crow. I like him not."
"A warg he may be," Ygritte said, "but that has never frightened us."
Others shouted agreement. Behind the eye holes of his yellowed skull, Rattleshirt's stare was malignant, but he yielded grudgingly. "These are a free folk indeed," thought John. They burned Corran Halfhand where he'd fallen, on a pyre made of pine needles, brush, and broken branches. Some of the wood was still green, and it burned slow and smoky, sending a black plume up into the bright, hard blue of the sky. Afterward, Rattleshirt claimed some charred bones, while the others threw dice for the ranger's gear. Ygritte won his cloak. "Will we return by the Skirling Pass?" John asked her. He did not know if he could face those heights again, or if his Garen could survive a second crossing.
"No," she said. "There's nothing behind us." The look she gave him was sad. "By now, Mance is well down the Milkwater, marching on your wall."
Sansa. The ladder to the forecastle was steep and splintery, so Sansa accepted a hand-up from Lothar Brune. Sir Lothar, she had to remind herself. The man had been knighted for his valour in the Battle of the Blackwater. Though no proper knight would wear those patched brown breeches and scuffed boots, nor that cracked and water-stained leather jerkin. A square-faced, stocky man with a squash nose and a mat of nappy grey hair, Brune spoke seldom. "He is stronger than he looks, though," she could tell by the ease with which he lifted her as if she weighed nothing at all. Off the bow of the Merlin King stretched a bare and stony strand, windswept, treeless, and uninviting. Even so, it made a welcome sight. They had been a long while clawing their way back on course. The last storm had swept them out of sight of land, and sent such waves crashing over the sides of the galley that Sansa had been certain they were all going to drown. Two men had been swept overboard, she had heard old Oswald saying, and another had fallen from the mast and broken his neck. She had seldom ventured out on deck herself. Her little cabin was dank and cold, but Sansa had been sick for most of the voyage, sick with terror, sick with fever, or seasick. She could keep nothing down, and even sleep came hard. Whenever she closed her eyes, she saw Joffrey tearing at his collar, clawing at the soft skin of his throat, dying with flakes of pie crust on his lips and wine stains on his doublet. And the wind keening in the lines reminded her of the terrible thin sucking sound he'd made as he fought to draw in air. Sometimes she dreamed of Tyrion as well.
"He did nothing," she told Littlefinger once, when he paid a visit to her cabin to see if she were feeling any better.
"He did not kill Joffrey, too, but the dwarf's hands are far from clean. He had a wife before you. Do you know that?"
"He told me."
And did he tell you that when he grew bored with her, he made a gift of her to his father's guardsman? He might have done the same to you in time. Shed no tears for the imp, my lady. The wind ran salty fingers through her hair, and Sansa shivered. Even this close to shore, the rolling of the ship made her tummy queasy. She desperately needed a bath and a change of clothes. I must look as haggard as a corpse and smell of vomit. Lord Petar came up beside her, cheerful as ever. Good morrow. The salt air is bracing, don't you think? It always sharpens my appetite. He put a sympathetic arm about her shoulders. Are you quite well? You look so pale. It's only my tummy, the seasickness. A little wine will be good for that. We'll get your cup as soon as we're ashore. Petar pointed to where an old flint tower stood outlined against a bleak grey sky, the breakers crashing on the rocks beneath it. Cheerful, is it not? I fear there's no safe anchorage here. We'll put ashore in a boat. Here? She did not want to go ashore here. The Fingers were a dismal place, she'd heard, and there was something forlorn and desolate about the little tower. Couldn't I stay on the ship until we make sail for White Harbour? From here the king turns east for Braavos, without us. But, my lord, you said we were sailing home. And there it stands, miserable as it is, my ancestral home. It has no name, I fear. A great lord's seat ought to have a name, wouldn't you agree? Winterfell, the Eyrie, River Ron, there's our castles. Lord of Harrenhal, now. That has a sweet ring to it. But what was I before? Lord of Sheepshit and master of the Drearfort? It lacks a certain something. His grey-green eyes regarded her innocently. You look distraught. Did you think we were making for Winterfell, sweetling? Winterfell has been taken, burned, and sacked. All those you knew and loved are dead. What Northmen who have not fallen to the Iron Man are warring amongst themselves. Even the Wall is under attack. Winterfell was the home of your childhood, Sansa, but you are no longer a child. You're a woman grown, and you need to make your own home. But not here, she said, dismayed. It looks so small and bleak and mean. It's all that and less. The Fingers are a lovely place, if you happen to be a stone. But have no fear, we shan't stay more than a fortnight. I expect your aunt is already riding to meet us. He smiled. The Lady Lysa and I are to be wed. Wed? Sansa was stunned. You and my aunt? The Lord of Harrenhal and the Lady of the Eyrie. You said it was my mother you loved. But of course Lady Catelyn was dead. So even if she had loved Petyr secretly and given him her maidenhood, it made no matter now. So silent, my lady, said Petyr. I was certain you would wish to give me your blessing. It's a rare thing for a boy born heir to stones and sheep pellets to wed the daughter of Hoster Tully and the widow of John Aaron. I pray you will have long years together and many children and be very happy in one another. It had been years since Sansa last saw her mother's sister. She will be kind to me for my mother's sake, surely. She is my own blood. And the Vale of Arryn was beautiful. All the songs said so. Perhaps it would not be so terrible to stay here for a time. Lothar and old Oswald rowed them ashore. Sansa huddled in the bow under her cloak, with a hood drawn up against the wind, wondering what awaited her. Servants emerged from the tower to meet them. A thin old woman and a fat middle-aged one. Two ancient white-haired men and a girl of two or three with a sty on one eye. When they recognized Lord Petyr, they knelt on the rocks. My household, he said. I don't know the child, another of Keller's bastards, I suppose. She pops one out every few years. The two old men waded out up to their thighs to lift Sansa from the boat, so she would not get her skirts wet.
Oswald and Lothar splashed their way ashore, as did Littlefinger himself. He gave the old woman a kiss on the cheek and grinned at the younger one.
Who fathered this one?